Lunch with Leon.
So hello and welcome to another episode of Lunch with Leon. Now, you do know that this show is not like live radio news, trying to bring you the very latest up-to-the-minute stories, because, you know, I like to spend time with our guests talking in depth about a few interesting things. But the extraordinary developments of the past week in politics is such unbelievable political intrigue. We're seeing such extraordinary political shenanigans now on a daily basis. And I really wanted to explore this some more. What it means for us, what it means for the economy, and of course, what it means for transport. So I'm joined by two special guests. Steve Norris, the former Conservative Party chairman, former government minister, and still very active and influential across the stage. And Stephen Bramall, who's an expert public affairs advisor and former senior civil servant. Since we've got two Steves, I'm going to call Steve Norris Steve, and I'm going to call Steve Bramall Stephen, just in the hope of making all that work properly. So let me set the scene. Why am I so energized about all this? And as we've said on this podcast previously, we're borrowing as a country roughly the cost of the Elizabeth line every month. So in the financial year ending March 26, we borrowed £112 billion, a considerable amount. 8.3% of that borrowing is servicing our existing debt. So we're borrowing on a credit card to pay last month's credit card bill. And you and I both know this can't go on. The country ought to be focused on growth. It ought to be focused on employment. It should be laser-like focused on the advantages and prospects for technology. And it should be focused on reducing costs that we can pay our way. But once again, in what now appears to be a very frequent cycle, we're focused inwards on this new phenomenon, which is if something doesn't go right, change the person, change the leader. And instead of concentrating on the future and our development, our country goes through this long period of asking itself, who would be the right leader? What are their qualities? And bringing out on social media all the things that they've ever said or done in the past. And this is, in my view, totally counterproductive. So I just wanted to explore this with people who've either got great political nous and understand political intrigue, and having either been in government or been in the civil service, and have a real knowledge about how all this works. That's where I've got to, and I'm going to ask Steve Norris, what are your views about where we are?
Well, my considered view is that we're going to hell in a handcart. In simple terms, your introduction really nails it, which is that our borrowing is at a ludicrously high level. And what worries me is that there seems to be quite a sort of general understanding among senior ministers at the moment that the bond markets are just there like a sort of family piggy bank to be emptied at will, when in fact, of course, these are a very sophisticated group of generally sovereign wealth funds and elsewhere, who will lend to you if they believe that one day you will actually repay them. And the cost that they will charge you, and this is actually exactly what happens if you go to your bank for an overdraft or if you've got a mortgage, you know, they will charge you a rate appropriate to what they see as your risk. Now, we are paying, not only are we borrowing a huge amount of money, as you say, every single month, but actually we're doing so at an increasingly high interest rate. And it reminds some of us of the time during Dennis Healey's time in the 70s and very early 80s, when, you know, the country had literally run out of money and Dennis Healey was on the tarmac at Heathrow, ready to go off to the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, for an emergency bailout. I mean, I think we're dangerously near that kind of proposition right now. And that's absolutely appalling for a country which really ought to be, you know, in a far better state economically.
And I think we remember, Steve, don't we, that the last time Dennis Healy went to the IMF, he came back with the money, but he also came back with some very, very strict conditions, which would make any recent government spending cuts look pathetic.
Absolutely so. That's exactly right. But then, of course, I think one of the things we have to understand is that this government needs to get that message now before being told by the IMF. I mean, when the total amount collected in income tax in 2025 is equivalent to the benefits bill, you know, and that includes some pension spend and all the rest of it. Yes, I get all that, but it's still a monumental amount of money that's going out to pay people not to work and therefore not to be contributors to the economy rather than, you know, takers from it. I mean, if we got rid of 180,000 civil servants, no offence to Stephen Bramall, of course, it was an excellent example, but if we got rid of 180,000 civil servants, often very, very decent people, we'd still have over 100,000 more than we had in the 1980s when I was in government.
Stephen, what's your view?
Well, I mean, I certainly agree with everything that Steve's just said. I mean, I think I would overlay that a bigger concern, which is to what extent is the government and indeed local government becoming ungovernable? Because when you look at what's happening, certainly within the Labour government at the moment, but also the results of the local elections, we're seeing a significant fracturing of voter intention, if I can put it like that. And we are moving into an era of clearly coalition government, both nationally and locally. And I'm concerned about whether or not coalition government in this country, given the polarization of views and the splintering of views, is actually going to work. I'm really nervous about that. And I've heard, just to take a very local example, I've heard stories, if you look at the local elections, where Reform have taken control of local authorities that have been run by Labour for the best part of 50 years. I've heard stories of officers saying they can't work with Reform. So overlaying everything that you've just said about the kind of the bond markets and the IMF bailing us out, you also have a fracturing of government at national and local level, which I think creates even greater uncertainty. And you've seen the way that the bond markets have reacted to every bit of breaking news about whether or not there's going to be a leadership challenge or there isn't going to be a leadership challenge and who might the contenders be and so on and so forth. And I think that's a really an additional danger that we're facing. It's really, really concerning.
The other thing that's really worrying me about all this, there is this, this will be our seventh prime minister in 10 years if Starmer goes. And whilst there's no doubt there's some problems, in my view, Starmer's biggest problem is his majority is too big. Because if you've got 174 as a majority, he's got 411 MPs. He's only got 95 jobs to give out. And so therefore, you've always got about 300 odd who either think they should have a job or had one and have lost it, which means, frankly, if I'm Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister, my biggest opposition is not sat opposite me in the House of Commons, it's sat behind me. And that's evidenced by the fact that with his huge majority, he can't get his welfare reforms through. He hasn't been able to do much of the reforms. Frankly, some of those welfare reforms I didn't disagree with. But here we have a Prime Minister with a big majority who can't get his way. And this is extraordinary in a democracy, isn't it?
Well, first of all, let's be clear, and I should be the one to say this, that six of the prime ministers were Conservative. So let's not gild the lily. And I don't want to excuse for a moment the sort of the furious regicide which overtook my party, thanks to our ludicrous system whereby members get the vote. But just looking at Starmer himself, you've hit, I think, Leon, on a hugely important issue. But I would take issue with the sense that, you know, the party is therefore ungovernable. I mean, one of the things that I think Starmer should have said on day one when that first revolt, if you like, against an incredibly modest 5 billion proposition off the benefits bill, which itself is over 300 billion. So that gives you an idea of how relatively insignificant this 5 billion was, in that he simply should have said, either publicly or privately, either in writing or in person, you're elected as Labour MPs, and your Labour government is proposing this, and I'm not asking you to approve it, I'm telling you to approve it. This is what you do. And what's interesting about Starmer is that he shares something with Rishi Sunak. They're both decent people. They're both, no doubt, in their own way, convinced of their honourability and their decency. And, he's an Arsenal supporter. We'll leave that to one side. But, you know, the truth is that actually he's not good at managing his own party. He doesn't have a political bone in his body. He's a civil servant. And so he allowed the tail to wag the dog. And it's wagged it hard ever since. You know, I remember the days when the chief whip of the Labour Party and his fearsome deputy would literally just sort of get a couple of members in a corner and threaten them with serious physical violence unless they stepped into line. And, you know, they got the message, which is, look, you're not here to play games. You're here to support the Labour government of which you're a member. And Starmer has been terrible at that. It's one of the reasons why I think they now want somebody else, somebody who will give leadership. And that's, I suppose, the great enthusiasm, you know, for Andy Burnham, that he's seen as a leader. Even Wes Streeting is seen as a leader. Whether Angela Rayner is seen as a leader or not is another matter. But the fact is, Starmer has lost control of his party. And given that it's such a huge majority, that's very dangerous indeed.
Well, again, I echo everything that Steve has said. And I for me, there's always a danger for people of our age and generation looking back fondly at the past. It's always a dangerous thing to do. But to echo what Steve has just said, I think one of the difficulties that any leader now has is that the quality of parliamentarians is now so poor, and I think a lot of people would kind of outside of parliament would political commentators would generally agree with that. And you know, why is that? And actually, for my money, I go back to Tony Blair's reforms, parliamentary reforms, which resulted, in my view, in really experienced people from the outside world kind of shunning the idea of taking up a parliamentary career. And there is now so much scrutiny on parliamentarians that actually we're bringing into parliament people who see politics as a career, not a vocation. And I think that's a really damaging place to be. So it's just reinforcing this sense of, to Steve's point, Keir Starmer isn't actually a politician. That's fundamentally the problem. And we replace Keir Starmer with someone else, and we might have kind of the same sort of problems. Andy Burnham has obviously experience as a former cabinet minister, by all accounts, not a particularly great one. He's obviously got experience as, you know, the mayor of Greater Manchester, but that's relative to number being prime minister, that's a relatively easy job. So it's the quality issue that bothers me more than anything else. As I say, it's dangerous to look back at the past and look kind of the giants of the political world that the three of us can all remember. But I think it's a truth.
Well, look, I'm not so worried about looking back on the past, because we all then remember a good old spat between Tony Benn and Enoch Powell was a joy to listen to, because they were very intelligent, very clever, logical, thoughtful people. And when they finished speaking, you knew exactly who you didn't agree with and why. And one of my theories is, and this is Blair, unfortunately, in the Blair years, we started market testing policies, and only the policies that the majority of people surveyed liked came forward into proper government policy, which means that you're always scrabbling around in the middle ground. And frankly, politics most recently has been the fight for shades of grey in the middle ground. Therefore, it's not surprising the far left and the far right pop out occasionally because people get fed up of the shades of grey in the middle ground. But they were career politicians with education. Ken Clark said recently that when he first came into the Commons, there truly was a range of talent and experience in the Commons. But if he looks at it now, they're all graduates who've worked for the party, have done fundraising, have been researchers, and in general terms, haven't done anything else at all. So the Commons appears to be attracting people, frankly, who've got nothing else to do.
And you know, just to comment on this, first of all, one of the really troubling facts about the current government is that there isn't one of them that we can find that's actually ever run a business. Not one. Now, that's one of the big differences from the days, not just of the Conservatives, but of the Labour Party in the years up to, in my view, the one event that has really destroyed democracy, and I use those words advisedly, and that's the advent of social media. Because what social media has done in its way is to describe every MP as corrupt, useless, indolent, in it for themselves. They get daily threats. We know where your wife works. We know where your children go to school. We have turned, social media has turned politics into an incredibly unpleasant place to be. If you wanted to write to me to tell you you thought I was wrong, you wrote to me. You got a pen out and put it on. It always had green ink in it for some reason, but nonetheless, you wrote to me and I would write back. You seldom bothered to write again, but if you did, I would write back. That's as simple as that. These days, you know, MPs get hundreds of emails every day from constituents who, if they haven't had a reply in 2 hours, send another one saying, where are you, you indolent, useless member of parliament? The climate for people to go into politics is just appalling. I remember a great friend of mine who was, you know, exactly in this sort of position and just said, I'm out of here. I just don't want to be part of this anymore. This was a chap who had been in Parliament with me, who just said, it's horrible these days. It's awful. Now, that's something I lay firmly at the door of social media. And we really do have to, I think, as a country, take on not just this idea of should we allow people under the age of 16 to participate in social media. We should be asking ourselves why we're allowing people like Zuckerberg and his cronies in Silicon Valley to be destroying democracy. And Leon, I'm quite serious about that. I believe this is an existential threat to democracy. Incidentally, if you add to that the advent of AI, I now look at a picture or a film, and I can't actually guarantee that the people that I see, who I think I recognise, are actually the people that I recognise.
Yes. And are they doing the things they actually appear to be doing? And have they said the things they appear to have said?
Absolutely. So we're in a very difficult position. And just to add something to what Stephen was saying, we now have a five-party system. The old two-party system does look as if it's dead. I'm not saying that's necessarily even a bad thing. But we now have a five-party system in which I suspect, were we to have a general election, whichever party won would be only the one who won the most seats, would very unlikely have an overall majority. And that's something which, as Stephen says, represents a real, if you like, challenge to us as a country. We've had one coalition in recent years, and it lasted five complete years, a whole parliamentary term, but it destroyed one of the participants. And I think we have to be clear that any prospective coalition would be really quite difficult, really, these days. What is this? Is this sort of, you know, Green and Labour? Is this the Tories and Reform? I mean, what sort of combination are we thinking of? None of them are particularly attractive. I think democracy in this country, quite apart from the difficulties of the current government, is in a real state of crisis.
For that matter, we can't go around the world telling certain other countries how good democracy is, can we? Because, frankly, the way it's playing out here and indeed across the Atlantic is a very shocking example about democracy. And I think we're allowed to feel like this because we have between us a considerable amount of experience and we sort of tend to know what works and what doesn't work. And so we find ourselves as a result of this terrible situation. I keep on reminding myself, because I think this is a dream. We have a prime minister who was voted in with a landslide, with a huge majority, where things were progressing not very quickly because of tensions within the Labour Party as well as the Labour government. And now a couple of years in, after some local government results, somebody who was elected to serve their constituency is going to step aside in order to allow somebody who is not an MP and has been elected for a term of office as Mayor of Manchester to be able to participate in a by-election whereby if he gets elected and gets into the House of Commons, he is most likely to stand in a leadership challenge to the Prime Minister. That's a funny sort of democracy.
It's bonkers. Can I comment on that, Leon?
Stephen.
One of the things that I find really strange about the situation that the Labour Party has now found itself in is that Andy Burnham is going to be campaigning to get elected back to the House of Commons, and presumably ministers will be encouraged to go up to that constituency and help him win that by-election, which is not actually a shoo-in, in my view, given what's happened at the elections on the 7th of May. So government ministers are going up to the constituency to campaign for Andy Burnham in the knowledge that Andy Burnham will then be challenging their prime minister. I mean, how bonkers is that?
Indeed. It's a misuse of democracy.
Correct.
I tell you, just to say, to echo what Stephen's saying, I think it's a very odd choice of a seat to fight.
Yes, because it's not a, it's a 5,000 majority or something?
Yep.
I think Reform and the Greens are going to have a field day.
Just to throw in some statistics there, constituency, the Labour Party enjoy a majority of 5,399, which makes it a marginal seat. What is more interesting is that council elections around that constituency saw Reform knock the Labour Party 4-6 in council after council in areas which should be rock-solid Labour seats. More to the point, in wards that are part of the Makerfield constituency, Reform actually got 50% of the vote on the 7th of May. So I think Andy Burnham is in for a fight of his life. His advantage, of course, is that he has a profile, he's generally quite popular, he's got exposure as the Greater Manchester Mayor, but it feels to me that certainly not a shoo-in. And the context in which that by-election is taking place creates a certain dynamic that I think is really quite dangerous for him. As I say, ministers are going to go up there to support him in the sure knowledge that he will then challenge their prime minister, which I find really, really strange.
Yes, and I think the conversations that will go on the doorstep will be very interesting to listen to. I think what you and I are both saying is that it's a very, very dangerous proposition for him. Actually, in some ways, I'll give him credit for it because he must know that. I think he is relying on the fact that he's a Makerfield boy. He knows the seat very well. He was overwhelmingly elected by the local people in the mayoral election. And I no doubt they like him and rate him. But I think that whenever you've got, you know, the other parties circling, which they clearly will, I mean, everybody will be there. George Galloway will probably be there, never mind the Greens and Reform. If I were the Tories, I'd sit this one out. I wouldn't even bother because I'd like to see all the votes that the Tories might have had going to somebody who would stop Andy. I mean, that's absolutely fine. You know, I mean, I think it's a very, very dangerous thing. But let's assume that he wins. If he wins, then he will almost immediately, I think, trigger a vote of confidence effectively in Starmer. And then the question is whether Starmer would stand against him in an election for leader. And if Starmer doesn't, then we may see Andy simply become prime minister on the basis of simply being a member of parliament. Such is the enthusiasm from Wes and from Angie, and no doubt from many other backbenchers who see him as, you know, the sort of saving grace of the party. Whether that's true or not is another matter. Here is a man who has already said he doesn't think that bond markets really matter. And if that's his approach to the economy, he's going to have a very, very, very hard recognition of the realities of life.
Maybe for the last few minutes on this, we could just translate that into transport, because here I am back on my soapbox again. No matter what route the Labour government take, it is unlikely the economy is going to improve very much. And depending on who the leader is, depends on what rate. So I have this theory that long before franchising of the bus network, the electrification, the decarbonisation of our road transport fleets is finished, the government will have run out of money. And it doesn't take the IMF to do that. Frankly, as we've discussed, the rest of market forces, the global market forces, the willingness of people to lend us money, the willingness of people to pay more tax. I can see a situation where many of these government flagship policies will get into some very serious trouble. There's no doubt that the renationalisation of the railways is very popular in the country. It's one of the few Labour government policies that is still holding up, unlike health and education and elsewhere. But actually, the costs will continue to rise and some really serious cuts will have to be made across a number of things. And frankly, it's very hard to attack welfare. It's very hard to attack health. It's hard to attack education. Transport has got to be in the firing line for some very serious surgery, I would have thought.
I completely agree. Transport has always been a soft underbelly, if that's the right way of putting it, when it comes to financing and fiscal policy and all the rest. And I think the problem that the Labour government has created for itself, if you take railways as an example, privatisation of the train operating companies isn't going to change the performance of the railways one jot. It doesn't affect how signals perform. It doesn't stop engineering overruns. It doesn't stop leaves falling on the line in the autumn and all the rest. And as the three of us know, the organisation that was responsible for most of the, or is responsible for most of the delays and cancellations on the network is Network Rail and will be Great British Railways. So the public isn't going to see much of a difference, frankly. And I think that the railways will become a soft target for cuts because the Treasury, from what I understand anyway, the Treasury already have the railways in their line of sight for cuts. And I think that will be true of other parts of the transport sector, including buses, dare I say it, and including some of these big projects, which will just get slowly pushed back down the road. And I think the critical thing to highlight is that whereas today, Network Rail's five-year funding settlement can't be cut once it's been agreed, it is explicit in the government's policy documents on its reform programme for GBR that in future, through a control period, GBR's funding will be capable of being cut. Why would you say that if that isn't your intention?
I just add, incidentally, that whilst I agree with everything Stephen says about the impact on rail services, what you would actually do if you were told you needed to cut is not do things that you haven't already started to do. So the first thing is forget the new bypass. That's never going to happen. You know, that's going to be off. Forget any road improvements. They're not going to happen either. We might just about spend some money on potholes because that's got a lot of voter interest, and doing something about that would actually be genuinely popular. But it's pretty easy for the DfT, unfortunately, to simply stop doing improvements, stop making things better, stop providing new infrastructure of any sort. That's, I think, where the big cuts will come. But I'm absolutely no doubt that Stephen's right. Those cuts will come.
So there we have it. We are in the middle of yet another dose of political intrigue, which I have to say in moderation is always rather exciting to see, because I think it was Tony Benn who said that if you can't remove the government, you don't have democracy. So to some extent, we're seeing democracy at work. But frankly, I think like a lot of our listeners, I'm having a bit too much political intrigue to properly enjoy, because all of the consequences appear to me to be negative. We won't be able to focus on growth. We won't be able to focus on skills and employment and all those things. We are going to be focused on who is going to be the next leader of the Labour Party, who is going to be the Prime Minister of this country, the consequent shufflings in the cabinet. And no matter what happens, there will still be roughly 174, maybe 173 people in the House of Commons on the Labour side without a job who will be agitating to have one, and who will be potentially disagreeing with the ministers that do. And this looks like a very rocky road. It looks like a very bad way to run a business. You wouldn't run a place like this if you were trying to make equipment, would you? Because it's just such a shocking way to behave. So the economic consequences look poor. The future for democracy looks poor. And for those of us in the professional transport sector, this looks like we're about to embark on a period where the sort of funding that we hoped might be available for improvements, for increases in speed or frequency, improvements across the transport network, look like they're going to be sunk in the very near future.
On that cheery note, where do we look for optimism? It's quite interesting, actually, that I was at an event yesterday where someone from a local authority think tank was talking and was articulating some of the points that I made earlier about, you know, the governance of local government and how difficult it's going to be for authorities to drive forward policy agendas and so forth. But she did actually end up on an optimistic note, saying there are a lot of good people in local government, which I have to say I slightly raised my eyebrows at. But she was optimistic that the local government, on the local government side at least, they would find a way forward. So if we want to end up on an optimistic note, perhaps that's possible. But the omens aren't great.
And Steve, final thoughts from you?
Oh, no, I think I agree entirely with your summing up, Leon. I'm sorry to say that, I'm an old Tory. As it happens, I'm rather pleased with the performance of our party leader because she reminds me of Margaret Thatcher. And I think she's got the same clarity and the same courage. And she's cutting through and clearly always seen as the best of the party leaders, but got a huge hill to climb. No, I'm pretty pessimistic. And as we've said during this really interesting episode, which I hope a lot of people will listen to because it's an important issue that we've been discussing, that we are facing not just an incompetent government, but the decline of democracy, decline of respect for democratic government. And we know what the alternative to that is. It is government by people who will shoot you or lock you up if you disagree with them. Half the world is led that way, a half that perhaps we don't particularly admire or like, but whether it's Xi's China or Putin's Russia, or so much North Korea, and so many places in the world where a strong man, it's always a man, runs the entire country and will imprison you if you disagree with anything that he says. That's the alternative. That's the alternative to democracy.